You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 22nd, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Joe Margolis, author of Thanks for Everything, Now Get Out. Can we restore neighborhoods without destroying them? Meanwhile, as Omicron tears through the upper Midwest and Northeast, New York specifically as well, the Biden administration has made its policy of sending out 500 million tests free, free tests official starting in a few weeks. And New York hospitals say they have largely run out of the singular monoclonal antibody treatment that shows efficacy against the new variant. So there's only one left that works against Omicron. Tim Pool and Joe Rogan can probably still get it, though, if they want. So the followers of that kind of media who were told that this was an alternative to vaccination, they may be out of luck. And in Israel, people ages 60 and older and medical workers are beginning to receive their fourth vaccine dose. They are one of the wealthy nations that has access to the Pfizer vaccine, which has shown promising efficacy against Omicron spread. So the rest of the world, occupied Palestine, not so lucky. Senator Joe Manchin, ever heard of him? His PAC has seen a recent surge in corporate donations in the past few months, according to a CNBC report. Donors include Lockheed Martin, Goldman Sachs, American Express, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and more.
All that stuff normal folks like.
Right. West Virginians. They're so in favor of the American Express donations. And he's been, they also got natural gas donations here. He's been getting a lot of money from the industries that he's protecting. And it's official. The 1,400 striking Kellogg workers have ratified a new contract that solidifies veteran benefits, veteran worker benefits, protecting workers from being replaced by less experienced, cheaper labor, but with wages increasing for all tiers of workers in experience. And lastly, the Biden administration has said to be considering extending the student loan payment pause. Pressure is working. Now he has to cancel student debt. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out for the rest of this week, for the rest of this year, except for our best of programming that you will see in the, I guess we have
beginning
one
start Friday.
On Friday. Yeah. And then for the rest of the week of the year, 2021, I wanted to talk a little bit more about this monoclonal antibody report. Because as I mentioned when I was headlining this, hospitals are basically running out of monoclonal antibody treatments that work for the Omicron variant. Now, there are three monoclonal antibody treatments that have been used by hospitals recently, but major hospitals in the New York region have had to stop with the monoclonal antibody treatment because, as I mentioned, the one that is effective against Omicron is basically not available. New York University and Valley Health System in northern New Jersey notified doctors Sunday that they are suspending monoclonal antibody programs and will not offer the treatments until they receive more shipments from state and federal health agencies. Monoclonal antibodies, which are laboratory-made proteins that mimic the immune system's mechanism for protecting the virus from entering healthy cells, have been used to treat patients at high risk of becoming seriously ill from the coronavirus, but only one of the available antibodies, Sotrovimab, made by GlaxoSmithKline, appears to be effective against the Omicron variant, which accounts for the majority of the new cases in the United States. So basically, that particular monoclonal antibody treatment, they're running out of it.
Relax, bro. Monoclonal antibodies will save you. That message didn't last very long.
Didn't last very long. And the thing about it, too, is that say you're 90, say you're at risk and you are fully vaccinated and yet you still get COVID and the Omicron variant breaks through and you get seriously ill. You have a pre-existing condition. You're at risk. What have you? Those monoclonal antibodies could save your life, especially if you're older, even though the vaccine is incredibly effective at preventing serious illness and death. But there are people in this country who have been duped by right-wing grifters that are going to be taking up a lot of the supply of the monoclonal antibody treatment that's now available for Omicron, that only works for Omicron.
Yeah, like there was a secret way out that Joe Rogan was saying, yes, not that big of a deal. And that permeated. People thought that way, particularly before Omicron, like, oh, well, you know, it's one thing to be vaccinated, but at least there's like new thing, this other stuff like the monoclonal antibodies. Guess what? When you don't do anything to stop worldwide infections, this thing spreads around, starts mutating, all of a sudden that stuff doesn't work as well as it was, including the vaccines. But as we know, all the vaccines still do appear to do a lot towards keeping you away from severe illness. And I'm glad I'm boosted with the Pfizer, frankly, because now I am protected somewhat from infections as well.
So definitely get boosted, obviously. But the point is that when somebody like Donald Trump, when he got what ended up being this monoclonal antibody treatment, he got a bunch of experimental things when he got COVID in late 2020. When Joe Rogan gets it and he uses monoclonal antibodies and touts it as a part of his cocktail, when Tim Pool gets it and gets monoclonal antibodies, these people have resources that their supporters don't necessarily have, and they can probably, even if the hospitals in their area are now out of the one treatment that works for Omicron, they can make some calls. They can call their personal doctors or their fifth doctor that they have on staff, whatever. Or that there's, in Joe Rogan's case, I'm sure he has many people that he can call. But for the people that follow them, it's not so much. And not that appealing to somebody's sense of humanity is the right way to go. As I mentioned, if you are able to get vaccinated and then you get seriously ill and you're using a monoclonal antibody treatment and you have the funds to get one, you're also taking that resource away from somebody who is vaccinated and did everything they could and needs it to survive.
Yeah, and it's just like, look at the culture about this stuff. Looking at Yahoo Sports now, Dana White explains why he sought out Joe Rogan for COVID-19 treatment. He said, get monoclonal antibodies in you as soon as possible. So I did. I had the monoclonal. And this is said as if it's like, oh, look, here's a way through out of the coronavirus pandemic. But this is like the leader of MMA and Joe Rogan and like major media like charlatans, right? Like,
yeah.
This you need. I mean, we've said it all before, but it's really frustrating.
Absolutely. And we're experiencing frustration about some of this anti-vax stuff as just media hosts and people that work and cover this stuff every day. But it pales in comparison to what ICU nurses and healthcare workers are experiencing. So this went, this was tweeted out yesterday by an ICU nurse who is named Andrew. And he posted a two-part video to Twitter explaining why he actually quit being an ICU nurse because the Omicron wave became too much. He is based in Michigan, is my understanding. Michigan is a right-to-work state. And that becomes relevant when you hear him describe his experience.
My name's Andrew. I'm an ICU nurse, and I just quit my job in the hospital working in the ICU. I wanted to talk about a little bit my reasoning why. I'm not the only one that has done this. I'm not the only one that's talked about this. But I just want to give people a little bit of an explanation of why nurses are doing this. So, a little quick background, the way it works. A normal patient to nurse ratio in the ICU should be 2 patients per nurse. The norm right now is probably 3 patients per nurse every shift. Some places are doing 4 with a full ICU, and that's months on end. I mean, we've been doing COVID for 2 years nearly, so you can imagine how often we are in this situation. Med-surg floors are probably taking 8 patients per nurse, 10 per nurse, 12 per nurse some places, and this is nationwide that it's happening. a post-cardiac arrest patient, a post-code blue patient, should be a one-to-one patient, because I'll be in that room for 14 hours straight, because there is so much that is involved in keeping that person alive. But there's been multiple times where I've had two other patients, intubated patients, with COVID, and have to take that post-code patient as well in addition. Now, staffing in hospitals has been a problem long before COVID. We've been in a health crisis before COVID, but people don't want to really talk about that much either. We just want it to be normal. But full-time staff have been recognizing they can go work for a travel agency or a contract agency and take contracts with large bonuses and higher hourly wages. Full-time staff leave. Travelers are brought in for 4 weeks, 9 weeks, whatever their contract is. Then they move on to their next job. It's not very helpful. And you don't know what to expect. I mean, I know that comes with working in a hospital, but it shouldn't be, you know, that rocky every shift for staff or charge nurses, for nurse managers. And it's kind of hard to have.
Sorry, this was posted in two parts. Here's the next part.
Have three patients be precepting a brand new graduate nurse, you know, training them, helping out travel nurses around the unit because they don't know all the policies, they don't know what this doctor wants, what that doctor wants, they don't know where everything is, and you're making $35 an hour, they're making $80 an hour, $120 an hour, some of them. This is why more experienced nurses are leaving and hospitals are sucking graduate nurses into two-year contracts. And these nurses are anxious. They're terrified. They don't know how to do this job yet. They're not going to feel comfortable in this job until the one-year mark, maybe. And they're having to do it in outright ridiculous staffing conditions and taking workloads that are insane. I know many aspects of labor are experiencing similar things, but we in this field are seeing actual deaths as a result from it every single day. We all know there's no labor shortage. We have nurses. They just don't want to pay them.
Mm.
So they tell us if we strike, we are abandoning our team and our patients, and we care about our patients, so we don't. But that's how they keep control of us. So we need better laws. We need walkouts. We need strikes. And we're fed up. They took something that we're good at and we are proud to do, and they made us bad at it because we're stretched too thin. And these companies and our leaders do not care about these patients. They do not care about our lives, and they are actively stealing our lives from us.
So he wrote under this, he's at IntelligINT on Twitter. If anyone wants to send him some love, I also retweeted this video. He wrote under this video, "To be clear, I am not in a union. There are none here. I would love to be, but most places are all private systems." And yeah, you can form a union in a private company. That is like the completely, of course, people understand that. But the barriers and the difficulty to do so are heightened when you're in a right to work state. And this is a huge part of it. And like, I mean, at the start of the show, we were talking about monoclonal antibodies and the recklessness with which certain media members present cures that are not accessible for certain people. These are the consequences of that. The workers, the nurses, the doctors who are on the front lines of this. And like, we had at the beginning of the pandemic, the New York Times, let's look inside the hospital, inside the COVID ward. Let's look at the suffering that we're seeing. And people grappled that with that for a second. They clapped outside their windows for the healthcare workers. But there really is not a fundamental understanding of what it is like to feel like your life is in peril on a daily basis when you're going to work. And you also don't have any protection from your employer. That's blaming you for having concerns about your labor value and the fact that you're not getting paid enough and you don't have the security and you are stretched so thin, and there is no culpability on their end. There's no desire on their end to care about the patients. It's only on the workers that they thrust everything onto. And we're not going to give you any protection, any ability to band together with your colleagues and step up in solidarity and demand, you know, fair wages and fair protections. And so we're going to be seeing more of this because the brutality is not at the forefront enough.
This is why when politicians start talking about how we need to recognize the contributions of folks, politicians and particularly the business owners need to stop talking about recognition and start talking about compensation. Mm. And that's like all these, and it's also just absurdly despicable that we allow our hospitals to be owned by capitalists. I know just in the North Dakota area, the South Dakota hospitals are basically owned by Sanford, who is a subprime baron being investigated for child pornography, and also hospitals owned by like credit card company folks, right? Like these are the people who make the decisions for hospitals, and of course they're going to exploit these people and not give anything, and you're going to see more patients per nurses, and you're going to see accidents caused by that cause deaths, because we have underexperienced folks that are put in situations that they are overly challenging, and it's really despicable.
And it's not, to your point, it's not in any way rectified by some sort of pat on the back. That like we cannot keep asking nothing of capitalist owners in this country and everything of everyone else.
Like listen to
it's
this.
It's unsustainable.
This sort of language should be met with hisses. This is Joe Biden yesterday, or 2 days ago. To our frontline workers, I am in awe of your sacrifices. Thank you for the work you are putting in on this wave after a painful and difficult 2 years. We owe you a tremendous debt. Is that symbolic? I am once again asking for your strength, and yeah. I'll never forget it. What are you doing, though? Like, you're asking for strength, and you're going to get it, because people will, like, continue to make sacrifices until they get, you know, too burned out to do it. But what are we doing? What is this tremendous debt that we're talking about? Like, this is just a symbolic thing that politicians can say, oh, no, we recognize what you're doing. Good job.
But please keep your trauma sufficiently internalized so that we can keep our system running as is. I don't know. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Joe Margulies, talking about gentrification and more. Here is Sam.
Hey, folks, if you're still trying to figure out a last-minute holiday gift, or frankly, a post-holiday gift, check out our sponsor, Shaker and Spoon. Shaker and Spoon is the monthly cocktail subscription box. It delivers the ingredients and recipes for amazing craft cocktails right to your door. I don't know if you're aware of this, Emma, but cocktails are all the rage right now.
Oh, yes. Well, I love a good cocktail.
And what is not the rage right now is going into bars.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to recreate this at home, Shaker and Spoon is the way to do it. And you go to shakerandspoon.com/majority for $20 off your first box of delicious cocktails. Bradley, tell us about your experience with rye. I did the mezcal one. What was your rye experience?
So I made a Creole sling with my girlfriend. It had cold brew and orange bitters and a maple syrup type of thing. And it was very delicious. And
cold brew as in coffee?
Yes. Yeah. It was like a little pick-me-up with rye whiskey. It was delicious.
That sounds pretty good.
It's kind of like an espresso martini, but I don't like martinis, so I'm into that.
Well, this is what's good about it, is you can find different things that you like. They don't give you so much that if you don't like it, you're stuck with all this stuff. They give you multiple recipes for each box, and it's actually sort of fun to do. I was surprised. I'm a cocktail skeptic. For me, like a cocktail is put ice in my bourbon,
right?
Or put some olive juice in my gin. That's basically as far as I go. But this I really like, because you're able to like sort of, you try the recipe once, maybe with a little bit, see like, oh, maybe this is too sweet, or this is too botanical, or whatever it is. So this is how it works. Every month, Shaker and Spoon sends you a box with three original cocktail recipes with enough ingredients to make four drinks from each recipe. So that's 12 drinks in total. And they're giving Majority Report listeners $20 off when you go to shakerandspoon.com/majority. The ingredients are often things that are hard to find. The ingredients, generally that you can only buy in large quantities, which you don't want to do, unless you know that you like them. That's the thing about this, is it's both something you can enjoy in the moment, but it also is, I wanted to make it sound dry, it educates you, and you become a little more sophisticated about these things. And now I know, like, what... When I do go out to a bar, you know, probably in 15 years from now or whenever it is, I'm going to know I don't like this or I do like that. That's what I'm sort of psyched about with this. Plus, it's going to be fun because I have a feeling the next 2 months are going to be a little rough. ShakerAndSpoon.com/majority. You can click the link in the description. You get $20 off your first box of delicious cocktails. ShakerAndSpoon.com/majority. Thanks. Okay. Hey, folks. End of the year. My favorite sponsor of the year, really the past couple of years, Sunset Lake CBD.com. They are fans of the show. They've been longtime fans of the show. Their coupon code, left is best, for 20% off, sunsetlakecbd.com. They have fudge. They have gummy bears. They have tinctures. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have keef. They have coffee. They got salve and hand lotion. And all of their products, all of the highest of quality, you can check out third-party analysis of their CBD on their site at Sunset Lake CBD.
And there's a lot of junk you can get of CBD at, like, the store around the corner or whatever. This is not that.
No. It is the highest of quality. And they have a tremendous amount of integrity as a company. Mostly employee-owned, $15 minimum wage. They have donated thousands of dollars to different things, including we did that thing with them to give money to give directly over $20,000. But they also have given tens of thousands of dollars to food banks, to strike funds. These are a movement partner, folks. And here's the thing. A, we've got a ton of emails about people appreciating the product. And I know that they get a lot of repeat business. So you know their product is great. From outside of Burlington, a bunch of burners up there, Burlington, Vermont. Check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is best. One word, you get 20% off. Left is best. 20% off. All one word. Left is best. Hey, folks. Today's episode brought to you by...
We are back, and we are joined by Joe Margulies, author of Thanks for Everything, Now Get Out, Can We Restore Neighborhoods Without Destroying Them? Joe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. So, in a book about gentrification, we broadcast from Brooklyn, so that's pretty much synonymous with... When people hear the word gentrification, they often think of Brooklyn, honestly. But your book starts and really focuses on a kind of secondary gentrification, really. A community called Olneyville. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
That's right.
Gentrification isn't just in big cities like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. It's also in these places. So tell us a little bit about why you started here.
Well, in fact, gentrification now, it's accelerated so fast and so extensively in so much of New York and San Francisco and Boston that it's pointless to talk about trying to preserve some of these neighborhoods as the low-income neighborhoods that they were. But I discovered this neighborhood on the west side of Providence, Olneyville, in 2017, 2018, and this is the next wave of gentrification. In fact, there are a lot of people in Providence that commute to Boston, right? So it's the outflow from the gentrification that's already pushed people out of cities like Boston that reaches Durham, North Carolina, and et cetera. And what I found is that Olneyville, Providence is an old textile town. And, you know, went on really, really bad times when the textile industry collapsed. And so starting in the 50s, it had the disinvestment that we've seen. And Olneyville was the center of the Providence textile trade. And it just collapsed in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and went through decades of just devastation and became one of the most distressed areas in the whole Northeast. And around 2000, you know, late 1990s, early 2000s, a group of residents and their allies began to tackle the problems that Olneyville had. And they had a great deal of success. And so at first, what I thought I was going to write about was that neighborhood revitalization was possible, and that you could take a neighborhood that had been distressed for decades, highest crime rates, highest unemployment rates, everything we know, and really turn a corner. But what I discovered is, and this became the core of the book, the things that they did to make the neighborhood viable also made it vulnerable. And so the core moral question of the book is whether we can transform these distressed neighborhoods without setting the stage for their destruction. And if it does, if the tools we have now do lead to this destruction, well, that can't be right. What can we do about it? So that's the book.
Right. And I mean, that's kind of the cruelty of this particular case, because Olneyville was picking itself up and trying to organize around its own community. And the larger areas of Providence around Olneyville, you write, was essentially ignoring before the community banded together and was creating these systems that were becoming quite successful, they were fairly ignored. And then once they had success, time to gentrify, basically. Tell us bit about how that happened.
Well, and it's not just a cruelty. I mean, it is cruel, but it's also a moral obscenity, because what it implies is that the poor only get to live in wretched neighborhoods, right? As soon as it becomes something viable, something healthy, something safe, then the wave starts. And it really was this sort of sense, this dawning awakening. And if you track the coverage about Olneyville, as I did in the local press, it almost like it magically transformed, right? And as though there was no agency, someone waved a magic wand and neighborhoods got better and streets got safer. The specific steps that were involved was the reclamation of an old mill that had burned down in 89, arson, that the city of Providence just left there as a toxic waste dump for a decade. I mean, imagine that in a wealthy neighborhood, right? I mean, a building burns down, bam, it's gone in 45 minutes. In Olneyville, it literally sat there. It's 9 acres large, several buildings, littering the ground, and became a site of crime and prostitution and drug dealing for a decade. That was the start, the reclamation of that space, reclamation of housing across the street from that, improvement in the area around it that were high crime pockets, a new relationship with the Providence Police Department, forcing changes in the way the Providence Police Department did its work. Providence Police Department used to be horrific, brutal, one of the most brutal departments in the country, and revamping the local school. And those were the four steps that really brought this neighborhood out of its doldrums, out of its really bad distress. And sure enough, just as that happened around 2005, 6, 7, 10, you started to see people wake up to it. And then the wave of gentrifiers come from downtown Providence, moving west into Olneyville. And they're now, well, what we've seen is since basically the last 12 or so years, the neighborhood has gotten whiter, better credentialed, more unequal, and rents and prices have risen dramatically. So the clock is ticking, right? You can say it's at the verge of being Brooklynified.
Yeah, and I think that there is such a there's very little literacy in this country about what causes gentrification, because I think if people just look at the definition or Google it, right, it's, oh, this is kind of a passive a movement of people seeing supply and demand, and, you know, this is a lower cost area and they see potential in this area, and that's why a higher income person moves there. And that's obviously not the case. These are, this is the response to, as you write, a deliberate neoliberal capitalist kind of policy of governments, including the government of Rhode Island in this case, that allows for this to happen. If you could expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Look, neighborhoods like Olneyville don't just happen, right? They don't just suddenly appear. They are created. They are created as a result of a process. And in Olneyville, like in distressed neighborhoods throughout the country, the process is one of disinvestment, financial disengagement, creating structural incentives for people to who can move to move out to the suburbs, pouring resources into the suburbs, leaving cities cash strapped. During the 80s, during the Reagan administration, aid to cities fell by 2/3. Support for suburbs rose proportionally and dramatically. During that same period, the cities were beset by three crises: the AIDS crisis, the crack epidemic, and the homelessness crisis. So neighborhoods like this don't just suddenly appear. That is something done to them. And in the same way, gentrification doesn't just happen. It's something done to it as a result of creating these conditions where those who live there and who have endured these the distress for so many decades are powerless economically, politically, and are least able to fend off the influx of capital that comes in that is looking to grow. What capital always seeks to get bigger. That's what happens. And so it looks for areas where rents are low and potential is high. That's what it does. And it pours in at the expense of those who have been there and have endured this. And unwittingly, what residents in this neighborhood did by cleaning it up so much is that they raised the potential value of this space dramatically and made it irresistible to unrestrained capital. And that's the takeaway. The takeaway is, and this is the normative part of the book, the prescriptive part of the book, okay, you've got to empower those folks and decommodify this property so that it can't just be vacuumed up, hoovered up, and sold off to the highest bidder.
And you mentioned Reagan there. In theory, this is what the state is supposed to do. I mean, it should be able to stave off some of these and provide spaces for people to remain in their neighborhoods. But when was the last time the federal government invested in public housing? I'm genuinely asking because it must have been decades, right?
Oh, decades. Wow. There hasn't been a meaningful contribution to public housing. That is not just things like Section 8 housing, where you give someone a voucher and they can go to a private landlord and get a rental in the private market. Just building public housing, they haven't done that in numbers since the 70s, right?
I mean, right.
It was just been, and it was completely, well, in fact, the Reagan administration wanted to cut funding for the Department of Housing entirely, wanted to zero out the budget. Dramatic decline during the Reagan administration for funding for public housing. This is not what we do anymore. We don't build housing. And that's fundamentally because in this country, we do not view housing as a right, right? We don't view housing as something that people have a right to safe, viable, sustainable place to live, a roof over their head. You got to buy it on the market. And so the most vulnerable among us are recurrently left unhoused.
Well, you see this in the houselessness crisis and the conversation that we're having about this. It's a crime. It's so scary in Los Angeles right now, New York City. Oh, my God, what do we do? For a great majority of politicians or pundits who are discussing this, like building housing, free housing for houseless people is not even something that enters the brain because of that very dynamic that you say.
And it's a moral tragedy because, you know, the literature is pretty clear. If you just give people housing first, right? Just give them housing first. You will more than pay for the cost of the initiative through reduced crime, better performance in school, better performance in jobs, reduced levels of disorder. I mean, it pays for itself many times over. But unfortunately, we live in an age where folks take a carceral perspective on disorder, right? So when we see things that look unpleasant to us, our reaction is to physically pick folks up and move them out of the way. Either we move them to a different area. That's what's happened in Los Angeles, where you just create these no-go zones. It's happened in a lot of places. That's usually one step. That's part of the gentrification process. You just sweep people away. Or, you know, if you can't move them to another part of the city, you just pick them up and you arrest them for this violation or that, and they cycle in and out of the jail. That's what Rikers is.
Right. Well, we will get to that later in the program about some of Eric Adams's comments on this. But
yeah, right.
That's a little, I don't want to get too away from the premise of your book, because what I loved how you focused on this, the concept of this neoliberal precarity as implemented by governments, creating these conditions, because we have so strayed away from the concept of the state creating or the government creating systems that stymie this kind of dynamic, that they're basically at the whims of a convoluted nonprofit web where, as you write, somebody can parachute in from the outside and control everything, and they may have zero understanding of the community, and it creates a total mess, and the outcomes are terrible. And there's also just this insecurity, because if the funding runs out there's a decision made to stop subsidizing said nonprofit, okay, go away, they're gone. Tell us a little bit about how that affected Olneyville and other communities that you looked at.
Well, again, what I saw in Olneyville is replicated all over the country. What happened with the rise of neoliberalism, the idea of neoliberalism is, as your listeners probably know, is that the state has no business providing welfare. The market does it much better. That's the idea. So what the state really ought to do is create opportunities for the private sector to create profit. That's the goal. And let the private sector take care of these problems. Well, in a really badly distressed neighborhood, there's not enough opportunity for profit making. So those neighborhoods go underserved. The government has withdrawn, but there's no incentive for the private sector to step in. So what stepped into that void is the nonprofit sector. So all over the country, distressed neighborhoods are served by a lattice of NG nonprofits and community development corporations that, you know, live on a shoestring. Most of them are well-intended. They're very small. They survive on foundations, philanthropies, a little bit of municipal funding, a little bit of government funding. They're one budget cycle away from closing their doors. The problem is that they are generally and overwhelmingly staffed and run and their board direction is by well-intended, well-educated whites who do not live and are not of this neighborhood. There are, of course, exceptions, but that's the rule. And it's been the rule forever. And it's the case in Olneyville. And as a consequence, even with the best of intentions, you do not empower the residents of the neighborhood, right? What you do is you empower the staff and directors of these nonprofits. So A, it's precarious because they're one cycle away from shutting their doors, no matter how long they've been there. And in my study, when I was in Olneyville, there was an organization that taught English. Olneyville's now a predominantly Latino neighborhood. Shut its doors because it lost its funding. And it doesn't make for activists and advocates of the residents. It empowers the well-intended, well-educated outsiders who have no lasting connection to the neighborhood. And that's a fundamental problem. You're empowering the wrong people. That's what really has to stop.
Yeah, and as an extension of our neoliberal economic system and the way that that's common thinking with many of our government leaders, it's basically allowed them to take a hands-off approach to these kinds of problems. And I didn't even realize until reading your book how the number of nonprofits in this country exploded since 1970. And I'm a little cynical. I've always thought a lot of it's the scam, and a lot of it's for like wealthy white people to feel good about themselves. And then maybe they can go to a gala or two and dress up and drink champagne and then they feel great. But there's really, it's an extension of the new role of government under this order, which is we're essentially going to provide tax breaks for corporations. We're going to outsource all of this to the market. And then these are the consequences. And then we can have these pet projects for people so they can feel good about themselves while existing in this completely evil, immoral system.
I would say it's immoral. I don't think it's evil. It certainly leads to immoral outcomes. There's just no question. What happened is government withdrew from the scene. You've got an environment where the private sector is not incentivized to serve folks in distressed neighborhoods. So it's chronically underserved. So into that vacuum, into that void, flows the nonprofit sector. Just chronically underfunded, inadequate. And the thing is, and in most places, because it's underfunded and because it's inadequate, most of these distressed neighborhoods, they stay distressed. Because the problems are too great, the disinvestment has gone on for too long, the distress is too severe, and so for decades they just stay that way. And the great irony, I was just personally struck by it, is that when, in spite of all the odds, a neighborhood pulls itself together and fixes its problems, despite lack of resources, lack of political capital, lack of power, lack of economic capital. And the reward for that hard work is what my book is about. Thanks for everything. Now get out. That just can't be. We cannot live in the wealthiest country the world has ever seen and allow this phenomenon to recur. And yet it does.
A few weeks ago, we had the guest on to talk about the Opportunity Zone explosion,
right.
Which is honestly a way for a lot of these. It's been used in many instances for wealthy people to have domestic tax havens.
Yes.
Where they can hoard their money in that area. Talk a little bit about that, if you feel comfortable, the opportunity zone phenomenon. Is that something that you feel is a continuation of a lot of what you wrote about here?
Absolutely. In fact, all of Olneyville was designated an opportunity zone.
Okay.
So absolutely. So you know and your listeners know the history of the opportunity zones. It was designed as, you know, the ostensible purpose is to bring capital, to attract capital into distressed areas, because unless you tinker with the market, unless you tinker with the incentives, capital won't flow in there because it can't make money. So, all right, we're going to create a way for it to make money. If you invest there, we'll guarantee a stream of basically give you a break on your taxes, on your individual taxes. But capital is always looking to get bigger. It's looking to maximize its potential. So it only goes to where it can grow, and it grows as a way by taking advantage of the prospect of gentrification. That is, you move in areas that are distressed, but are on the verge of changing. And so opportunity zones, there's nothing built in them that is a guarantee of success or resources flowing to the residents, right? There's nothing in opportunity zones that guarantee or require a living wage, or that you got to hire local folks, or that you got a contract with local workers or local business, nothing like that at all, right? All it is that capital flows into this neighborhood, and there's no control over what it flows in to be. So it can be, you know, condos that bring in greater wealth. I mean, it's, again, this is the neoliberal philosophy. The neoliberal philosophy is just bring in private money as though that will solve the problem, rather than empower the folks who are already there. Now, that's not a neoliberal philosophy, but that's what you need to do. And opportunity zones just bring in private outside capital. And there's very little evidence that opportunity zones have, since they've been created, have contributed to the well-being of distressed neighborhoods, and certainly not the sustainability of distressed neighborhoods.
Right. And I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit, or zoom out to some of the other suburban areas outside of metropolitan, or outside of major cities that I wasn't really aware how poverty has increased in those areas to such a degree, because that's common sense. Once the major cities push people out, poverty is going to increase there. But then once those secondary suburban areas are gentrified again, where is there a space for poor people in this country? That's the question.
That's exactly right. Exactly. And, you know, and in some respects, it's a rhetorical question. And the answer is, where is there a space? Well, in the current structure, the answer is wherever the environment is most wretched. That's the answer, right? And that cannot be. That we just cannot allow that to be. But of course, you're exactly right. I mean, the suburbs, particularly inner ring suburbs, are the that's where poverty has moved. Because in a back to the city moment, which we live in, notwithstanding the pandemic, which sort of temporarily slowed this, but it's starting up again. If you're going back to the city, well, where do you think people who are there already go? Right? They go to the suburbs, where resources, you increase our carbon footprint because there's much more use of private transportation. They don't have public transportation there. You don't have the same resources. You don't have the sort of institutional municipal support. You don't have the same close-knit neighborhood feel, right? Because people are more dispersed. It's a lose-lose proposition to flood people out to the suburbs like that, except for the folks who, you know, get to come into the new shiny places in Brooklyn, right? And, you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant suddenly a cool place to live. They're the winners, right? But we need to create a world where low-income folks who have endured these neighborhoods for decades, they get to be the winners.
And before we let you go, I do wanted to ask you a little bit about one of the solutions you proposed, the idea of a neighborhood trust. I saw that some places are starting to actually implement a version of your idea, which has got to be really exciting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the idea of the neighborhood trust, as I said, the fundamental problem, there are two problems fundamentally. One, you empower the wrong people, like I said. And two, there aren't enough resources to decommodify a sufficient amount of property, right? Just take it out of the speculative market, take it out of the market that just sells to the highest bidder. And so the idea of a neighborhood trust is at scale, neighborhood wide, you need to decommodify large chunks of property, use the money that is available in neighborhoods, amplify that neighborhood, the money that's already coming in, amplify that through impact investment. You could increase it even more through tax credits, not tax credits for wealthy outsiders, but for the benefit of the neighborhood and their residents, to decommodify property. It's very difficult to do in a place like Brooklyn, where the gentrification has already overrun it. You're now in super gentrification. Mm-hmm. That is, the first wave of gentrifiers are getting kicked out. And then transfer power from these nonprofits, the nonprofit outsiders, to the core of insiders. I mean, the residents themselves, who know the problems, who are the historic victims of the disinvestment that's gone on there. Empower them instead of the outsiders, and hold the resources in trust for the benefit of this. Let's just be clear, for the benefit of the poor. It's something we've never done in this country. And the idea of a neighborhood trust, which is picking up and it's exciting to me, is to transfer that power and that ownership to the poor. That's the goal.
I love it. And it's a great way to start from the ground up in those communities. When, as I mentioned this, I'm a big advocate for increased public housing. There is not a sufficient groundswell when it comes to our elected officials on that front.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. Just in the time I did this, I was researching this book, an illegal house that had been, you know, cut up into. They had a slumlord who would just cut it up into illegal apartments, way overcrowded, no heat, burned down in Olneyville, just right where I was doing all my research, and, you know, killed a young woman who lived there, Lucy Feliciano, 49 years old. This is what happens if you can't provide quality housing for the poor.
Yeah. I had my final question, but it totally flew out of my head. Because that story was so horrific. But this is my final question. The pandemic and the housing insecurity that created. How did that play into some of your research?
You know, Olneyville was one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in all of Rhode Island. Because, as we know, particularly in the beginning of the pandemic, again, this is a product of the economy that neoliberalism created. The folks who are the essential workers prior to the vaccine, who could not outsource all their risk, were the folks who lived in the poorest neighborhoods, right? They got to get up and continue to go to the restaurants and the grocery stores, and they are your service providers, right? The service providers who, you know, have to get on a crowded bus in the middle of winter when one person's coughing and nobody has windows open and nobody's vaccinated. And so everybody on that bus ends up getting sick. That's what it means to have been an essential worker. Now, fortunately, vaccination rates are much higher in Rhode Island, but prior to the vaccine, it devastated Olneyville. And in fact, one of the sources for my book, and just a hero, and I can't end this without his name should be remembered. Abelardo Hernandez moved to this country from Ecuador. He was just a hero in Olneyville and a local champion for his community. And he was taken from us by COVID. It was a great, great loss.
Well, I appreciate all the work that you do, and your book is really just an excellent read. I'd encourage everybody to check it out, perhaps a late Christmas gift or holiday gift. Joe Margolyes, author of Thanks for Everything, Now Get Out, Can We Restore Neighborhoods Without Destroying Them? Thank you so much. We will put a link to your book in the podcast description, and everywhere you're watching this, you'll see a link. Joe, thanks for your time today.
Not at all. Thanks for having me. Have a good holiday.
You too. All right, we are going to take a quick break, or actually maybe we will just wrap up the first hour of this program and head into the fun half. That was excellent.
It was, you know, just to comment on that, the prescription of doing things that benefit particularly poor people. That is as radical of anything you can do in this country. Mm-hmm. Like when Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign in North Carolina, like if America is doing something for the poor, the American government is doing something for the poor, something is very strange. Because typically all it does is the only way that a poor person can be saved is if they do enough service for a capitalist and that capitalist decides to, you know, set them up. But we should absolutely, like, all this sort of stuff is, sort of underwritten by the fundamental, like, coercion of society, like needing, like you said, like commodified housing, commodified healthcare, all these things put people on the streets, because we decide that the profit, part of it is more important. And it's like you said, it's moral obscenity.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, we are going to wrap up the first hour of the Majority Report. A reminder, we are doing a live show, The Big Live, Boston, January 16th. Check out the tickets and get them if you still have not. Looking forward to seeing everybody in Boston. And Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning tonight, right?
Yeah, Left Reckoning. I think we might do the normal time tonight, but it's going to be sort of a year-end wrap-up show. We're going to do the bump steer of the year. I think I might put Jayapal in the bump steer of the year. Yeah, so that's tonight. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. And I also want to plug some shows that I have nothing to do with. I've been listening to the TruAnon coverage of the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, and that is not only is it extremely informative, but it is very, very funny. And so I recommend that. And so that's my non-Matt plug for today.
I want to watch that or listen to that.
It's so good.
I've heard great things about TruAnon, but I've never actually listened. So definitely want to listen to that for sure. Check out the Nomi Key Show, which should be on today. And all the other things, just coffee, co-op, fair trade, coffee, tea, and chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. And Bradley may have some breaking news for us. FDA authorized Pfizer's treatment pill and Biden extend the student loan pause to May 1st. Okay, that's the breaking news. See you all in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.